Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're continuing our study in 2 Samuel, the life of David. We're going to be looking at chapters 10 and 11. Notice, if you would, the beginning of chapter 10. There's been some discussion of the relationship between chapter 8 and chapter 10. Some say it's two accounts of the same event. Others say, no, it's just out of chronological order, that 10 should logically come before 8. Others say, no, it's the final defeat of these northern Arminian tribes. So really, we're not exactly sure of the relationship between 8 and 10. I would think it's simply out of chronological order, but I'm not 100% sure of that. Notice the king of Ammon. Now, we learned from 2 Chronicles 19:1, the parallel for this, 1 Chronicles 19:1, that his name was Nahash, N-A-H-A-S-H, means serpent. Would you like to be named serpent? Anyway, he was the king. Now, we understand from 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse 1, that he was an enemy of Saul. And it may have been, as being an enemy of Saul, he was a friend of David, maybe the relationship here. But apparently, David had friendly relationships with this king of Ammon. Now, some say, because the word hesed is used in verse 2, I'll show kindness to his son, that implies a covenant. And that may be well true, for hesed does imply a covenant. It's used many times of God's covenant loyalty. And so the aspect of covenant is involved. Now, apparently this man died, and his son became the king. And David wanted to show a gesture of goodwill, a very common way of doing this, and he sent some representatives. But the man's counselors, now some say it was his military counselors. Some have said David's expansionistic tendencies were obvious from his other battles. But we don't know the exact motive. It doesn't seem that this was a trick or a ploy to start a war. It simply means that David had some sincere affection for the father. But whatever reasons, the ambassadors are going to be treated rather rudely based on the advice this brand new king gets from some of his men. And verse 4, we see exactly what happened. They shaved off half their beards and cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips and sent them away. Well, several things were involved here. Let's talk about the beard first. The Hebrews were not even to trim their beard. That goes back to Leviticus 19:27, because the cutting of the beard and some of the rituals involved with the hair have to do with idolatrous practices, and so the Jew was simply not even to trim or to round the corners of his beard. It's also a sign of extreme grief. You see that in Isaiah 15:2 and Jeremiah 41:5. Others say it was a way to humiliate prisoners of war. You might want to see Isaiah 20:4. And still others say it was a sign of slaves, meaning this man was implying that David was his slave by treating his representatives this way. Now, we know that the priests were the only Jewish people that apparently wore underwear in this day for modesty reasons. So to cut their garments off at the hip would be to expose them. And to cut half their beard off would be a sign of great shame to them. So they really were trying to be as rude, crude, and unattractive as they possibly could to these representatives. Now, apparently they came as far as Jericho. We learn from comparing several chapters, one in Joshua, one in Kings, that Jericho was not rebuilt at this time, and so it would be a stopping place, but not inhabited by a whole lot of people. And David hears about what happened and tells them to remain there until their beards grow out. Now, in verse 6, it seems that David was very upset about this, and the king realized that he maybe had made a mistake. And so he's going to hire some mercenary from these northern Arabian tribal groups, and they're going to come and try to help him. And notice it's a large group that he hires. In 1 Chronicles chapter 19:6, the sum of money that he paid is mentioned, and it's a huge weight in silver. A shekel or a talent in this period of time is not a coin, but a certain weight of money. Now, notice in verse 7, it says, David heard of it. He sent Joab and all his army. Now, the Hebrew is a bit ambiguous here. Some translate, even his mighty men, also his mighty men. The implication to me is that David not only sent the regular army with Joab, but also part of his elite bodyguard that had been with him during the Philistine wandering days. And apparently he sent them also with Joab to attack Ammon and this mercenary confederation of Arminians. When Joab got there, these two groups were almost ready to join up, which would have been a disaster for the Israelis. The ones from the city of this capital city of Ammon that we know as Amman, Jordan today, had come out just in front of their gates and set up a defensive position to greet the other soldiers. The other soldiers were coming in and were about to join up. Joab got there right before they did. But the problem with this is he found two forces, one at his front and one at his rear. And so therefore, notice the pietistic phrase in verse 12 where he says, "Let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of the people, for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what is right in his sight." Even Joab shows a little piety here. Now, what does it mean for the cities of our God? Well, some say this refers to the cities in the Transjordan area. This, of course, had been the area where Ishbosheth, Saul's son, had had his capital before he was killed by his own military commanders and the nation united under David. Joab, of course, routs this Assyrian force, and they are pretty much crippled to do anything else for a while. Although when the chief head of the Armenians hears about this in verse 16, he sends his entire force out. Now, because some of his troops were embarrassed and because he was willing to let them be mercenaries and if they could beat David, fine. But now he sees his own kingdom threatened. And we see this same struggle in chapter 8 where this very same man fights against David and David defeats him here. Now, David comes out to battle against this larger force of Armenians or Syrians, and he defeats them. Now, in verse 18, it says, David killed 700 charioteers. Well, in the parallel in 1 Chronicles 19:18, it has 7,000 charioteers, and that seems more reasonable. And then it continues, and 40,000 horsemen. Now, this horseman is very important, for in the parallel it says foot soldiers. But horsemen fit more, much more in this text. So I think we have a problem here where one text has part of the right thing and the other text has the other part of the right thing. You have to combine them together. And, of course, your modern Bible is an eclectic text. That means it combines the best reading as it can to get back to the original writing. Now, all this sets the stage for chapter 11. Why isn't David out doing what the kings did in the spring? Now, in the spring, men, the harvest was through, they were ready to plant, and the men were somewhat idle, and that's when the men normally went to war. In the spring, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all of Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, and David stayed at Jerusalem. Now, maybe this was the kind of battle that was a small battle and David wasn't expected to be there. Or maybe he was expected to be there but just decided not to. We're just not sure. Well, David apparently took a nap, as many people in the ancient world did, especially the hot countries. And they would take a nap up on the roof in the summertime because the cool breeze would come through there. And so in the winter, they would go downstairs to sleep. But in the hot months, they would go up on the roof. The roof became a place of social activity in the warm months. Apparently, after taking his nap, he was walking around the cool of the evening. Now, anything past 3 o'clock is evening, because 3 o'clock is when the evening sacrifice of the temple was altered. So 3 p.m. to twilight, or when the first star appeared, would be called evening in a Jewish reckoning of time. He was walking around on his roof, and he saw a woman bathing. Now, I don't think Bathsheba knew that she was being observed. Apparently, this had not happened before, and maybe David was just looking around and happened to spot her. I want you to know the temptation came upon David very suddenly. I think that's the way it happens to many people. David wasn't thinking about it. He wasn't prepared for it. It simply came upon him suddenly. And David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the son of Eliam?" Now, Eliam is the name here given, and if this is a Now, we don't know how many Iliams there were, if it's a common name or a rare name, but we do have one Iliam mentioned. The son of Ahithophel, A-H-I-T-H-O-P-L, who is one of the advisors of David. Now, there's been some speculation that if this was his granddaughter, maybe this is the reason that this advisor went with one of David's sons when he rebelled against David, because he was angry with what David did with his granddaughter. Maybe that's true. We just can't be sure. Now, this man was, if this is the same one, was a member of David's elite bodyguard called the 30. You might want to see 2 Samuel 23, verse 34. It's interesting to me that in 1 Chronicles 3:5, the name of Bathsheba's father is listed as Amiel, A-M-M-I-E-L. And the relationship between these two words is simply uncertain. Or if this particular military person of David is the same one mentioned here, we just can't be certain. The wife of Uriah the Hittite. Now, he is a Hittite. Hittites were the large empire to the north in what we would call modern Turkey. There were several Hittites mentioned in David's original band of thieves and robbers early. This man also grew to a place of military prominence in David's group. He's also a member of this special, the 30, in 2 Samuel 23:39. His name means, "My light is Yahweh." Any name in the Bible that ends in I-A-H is an abbreviation for Yahweh, and any name that starts with J and a vowel is an abbreviation of Yahweh. So apparently he had converted, and he was a worshiper of Yahweh. Matter of fact, he comes across in this whole chapter as much more religious and much more honorable than David the king, who was supposed to be God's representative. And David sent messengers and took her, and she came to him and lay with her, and he lay with her. Now, we're not sure about how Bathsheba felt about this. This was the king. He could do pretty much what he wanted to. Was she conspiring? Did she enjoy this? Was this something she wanted? We have no way of knowing. And when she had purified herself from her uncleanness, this is very interesting. It is obvious here that she was taking a bath, this idea of being cleansed from her menstrual period. Now, I want to say again, the sexual intercourse is not a nasty or dirty thing in the Old Testament. It has to do with the Jews' view of ceremonial cleanliness. Any bodily fluids that leaked in intercourse or disease or nocturnal emissions made someone ceremonially unclean. Apparently, she was washing after her monthly period, and David caught her then. Now, another possibility is that David is laying with her against the Levitical admonition of not laying with a woman during her menstrual period, Leviticus 15:24. And that may be a possibility here. But why mention it again in verse 4? They want you to be certain to know that it was just past her menstrual period, which means there's no way she could be pregnant by Uriah. It's David's child that we're going to talk about. And I think it's put in here for us to be very, very certain about that. Before I leave Uriah the Hittite, I wanted to mention to you that the Dead Sea Scrolls that we found of Samuel, as well as Flavius Josephus, the Jewish historian writing for the Romans during Jesus' day, say not only was Uriah the Hittite Bathsheba's husband, but he is also called Joab's armor bearer, which will make what happens later on much, much more hideous. Now notice in verse 5, "And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, 'I am pregnant.'" Now, they realize that from Exodus chapter 20, verse 10, and Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 22, that both of them deserve to die. This was the penalty for adultery in ancient Israel. And David sent to Joab, saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah came to him, David asked concerning the welfare of Jacob and the people and the state of the war. This was a pretense, and yet David does this. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." Now, there's several different theories about this. Some say, make yourself at home, relax, go home for a little while. Others say the idea of relating this to the vow of sexual abstinence during men on a military maneuver, and you might want to see 1 Samuel chapter 21, verse 5. And so maybe it was David's way of saying, go home and relax, be with your wife. I'm letting you off on your vow. We're not sure. Others say, wash your feet. Many times in the Bible, the feet is a euphemism for the male sex organs, and it may have been a very specific reference to go home and have relations with your wife. We're just not sure about that, but that seems to be the implication. And the king even sends a present to him. And this would be rich, delicate food from David's own table. David's kind of saying, enjoy yourself tonight at my expense. Little did Uriah know. Some think Uriah did know because the scuttlebutt at the palace would have been rampant with this little tale, and we can't read that into this story. We don't know. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. Why? Apparently because of this abstinent vow that we see in 1 Samuel 21:5. A soldier was not allowed to do that. And David asked him about it. Why have you not gone down? And look at verse 11. Uriah says, "The ark of Israel and Judah is staying in the temporary shelters." Now, this implies that the ark was with the army. We know that happened earlier at the ark with Phinehas and Hophni, Eli's sons. They lost to the Philistines. Maybe the ark was with the army. Some say it wasn't the full ark. It was just the ephod of the high priest so they could know the will of God on military maneuvers. But it seems to me it implies the whole ark. Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in an open field. Shall I go to my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing. he makes a vow, a religious vow, on the life of David. How ironical that he's swearing to God on David's and his own life that he won't do this irreligious thing, all the while David is trying to cover up his sin. I think it's very interesting. I'm going to skip down a little bit. David's going to write a note and send it to Joab and say, I want you to put him in the thick of the battle and move your troops back and he'll be killed. Now, Joab didn't do it quite that way. This is premeditated murder. No way you can get around it. He's going to involve Joab and the entire Israeli army in it, for they're going to have to know what's going to happen. Joab decided to do it a little different. Apparently, the men of the city would come out against some of the fortifications of Israel that were trying to besiege them from time to time. He put Uriah in one of these places. He knew that the Ammonites would attack. And the Ammonites did attack, and he ordered the Jews to pursue them all the way to their gate where the archers could kill them. And there were several men that also died. As a matter of fact, the parallel, it's not the parallel, it's the one of the Septuagints, the Lucian Septuagint, says that 18 others died. 18 other men died so Uriah would be killed. Now, when the servant is gone to tell David, Joab tells him, if he gripes at you about so many men dying, you also tell him that Uriah the Hittite is dead. Now, is this the beginning of blackmail, or is this Joab trying to cover up his what seems to be a military mistake? Well, whatever it is, we're not sure. But David, in some translations of the Old Testament, records this same thing. Why did you do that? And here's Uriah dies, and he's silent. Many other people died, so Uriah would die, so that David could cover up his own lustful acts. Now, the mention here in verse 21 refers back to an account in the life of one of the sons of Gideon by a concubine. You might want to see Judges 6:32, where a woman throws a millstone when the troops get too close to the city and kills this man. The word Jebusith is really Gideon, and you can see that in Judges 6:32, and the account's found, in Judges 9:50-54. So the servant does that, and David says, what's the deal here? Notice verse 25. This is what David says to Joab. Do not let this thing displease you. He says, tell Joab, don't be discouraged, for the sword devours one as well as another. Build your battle against the city stronger and overthrow it, and so encourage him. Now, isn't that ironical, pompous, a disgusting hypocrisy? David says, don't let Joab be discouraged over 19 men being lost. These things happen in battle. Don't you know Joab smirked when he read that? Earlier we've seen how Joab killed Abner, and David was so mad at him. And now David's doing the very same kind of vicious, premeditated act to cover up something for something for his own personal advantage. And he is the representative of the king. Now, when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for him, for her husband. Now, we're not sure how long this lasted. Some say 7 days, based on 1 Samuel 31, chapter 13. And that may be true. That seems the period of mourning. We can't read into this that how Bathsheba felt. She may have just felt a pawn controlled by men of power, men who controlled her life in that day. We don't know if she was happy or sad. It was really a time of mourning or simply a time of relief. I don't know, and you shouldn't read too much in it. And David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife. Then she bore him a son. The thing that David has done was evil in the sight of the Lord. Now, there's a play on words between verse 25 and verse 27 you do not see in English. Part of David's answer to Joab had to do with the idea, don't let this be evil. Seem evil in your sight. Let it be displeasing to you. A play on the word there. And God, it may not be displeasing to Joab what he did, what David did, but I guarantee you it's displeasing to God. The king was a representative of God. He was the under-shepherd of God. He was the representative of the righteous of God. That's why in Deuteronomy over and over it says you need a righteous king who will reflect who God is. And here is David acting so terribly. I do believe this should be somewhat of an encouragement to us as well as a warning to us, and I think it would run this way. Number one, I would say be careful of sin that comes upon you in a moment of passion. There are some things that we have decided we're not going to do because we are the people of God. David abused his privilege. Be careful of that, Christian. saying, well, God will forgive me. I'll just go ahead and do it. It's okay. My friend, David abused his privilege. He was caught in the moment of temptation because he did not decide earlier what was appropriate and inappropriate for his sexual life. Apparently, David's large harem, many concubines, did not satisfy his physical sexual desires. Many of them would have been political, but the man had all the sexual outlets he needed legally. Why would he be taken in a sexual sin? Because apparently, Deuteronomy said, don't multiply wives. David did multiply wives. Instead of calming the passion of the flesh, it excited it. Now, some say he just wanted it to be like other Oriental monarchs. Again, we cannot read the psychological motivation of David, but it's obvious here that sex with all of his partners did not stop him from being tempted here. I think we need to decide ahead of time that some things in our lives are sexually inappropriate for the people of God, and therefore we should not be overtaken by a momentary temptation. Okay, that's the ideal. Now, let's say you are overtaken in a momentary temptation. Not at lifestyle adultery or something, but a moment of temptation. What shall we do? It's extremely important to me that David is called a man after God's own heart, and yet a man of great sin. Yes, God can forgive, and God can overlook, and God can forgive us. Now, I'm not condoning what David did. I'm not even trying to give you an excuse of why David did it. It was a terrible, horrible, inappropriate thing. But our God is able to forgive. Now, that's not meant to be a license to sin. That's meant to be an impetus so we want sin. You see, the longer I live, the more I realize that the thing that keeps me from sinning is not God's big stick, but God's unbelievable love for me. And the more I understand His unconditional love, the more I don't want to do anything that might break Daddy's heart. So I sin less because of my love and respect and reverence for God, not because I'm afraid God will kick me out of the family or give me cancer, destroy me, or anything like that. Now, though I think it's very important we see that God dealt with David, I want to say this to you now. David paid a tremendously high price for his sin. Oh, yes, my friend, God can forgive and forget, but sin always runs its course. Yes, David was allowed to keep Bathsheba. A child is going to die. An innocent child is going to die because of David's sin. And the sword is going to whirl among David's own family because of David's rebellion. Yes, God forgave him. Yes, he remained king. But his family paid the price of his rebellion and sin. Here's a good example of the sins of the father visited on the children to the third and fourth generation. Here is David's family in terrible turmoil. A son's rebelling and being killed and sexually violating another member of the family. And a son taking David's concubines in public. All of these things, these sexual improprieties, they're going to happen to David's children. I want to tell you, God forgave, but sin will always run its course. I usually say this way, I think God will forgive us anytime we'll turn to Him because of the death of Christ. But if you've been an alcoholic, you may die of cirrhosis of the liver. If you've committed a sexual impropriety, you may have a child. You may get one of these communicable diseases. Now, God will forgive, but the consequences of our sin move on through our life. And I think we ought to see that. Now, chapter 12 is going to continue this discussion. And there are many difficult theological things that I wish I could answer here, but I just can't. But I think there's a tremendous message here for us. Something we ought to think through. There's great hope that God forgives and forgets. There's a great warning. To whom much is given, much is required. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he reap. David reaped in kind his own sin. It's interesting to me that C.S. Lewis, a theologian that I like so much from England, says that hell is going to be like that. We're going to be punished in direct proportion and kind to the sins of our life. Now, that's just speculation, but some of that is found right here. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you. I hope you'll think through this. I hope you take it as an encouragement for forgiveness and a warning not to walk in open rebellion. to make a decision in your heart that you're not going to walk those ways. And then when it comes, your mind will already be made up. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you. Have a good day. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. The Lord be with you.